Okay, so I'm going to be talking about what I referred to in the title as the zeroth law of turbulence, which is actually a terminology that was used by Uriel Frisch in a paper in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of London about a very basic fundamental law of turbulence, which is, I want to emphasize, an empirical law, and it's actually based on some what I would say are very surprising experiments. So I think everybody, for example, in superfluids, can name some surprising experiments. I mean, you can say, well, look, you have resistanceless flow through small capillaries when you go below the critical temperature, and that's a very surprising effect. And you can name other such surprising effects in superfluids. But one of the things I want people to take away from this talk is that turbulence also has some very surprising experiments, things that on the face of it are quite astonishing. And so I'm actually wanted to spend some time at the beginning reviewing experiments and then say a little bit about the theory. Okay, now in order to make sure that everyone is surprised, I want to begin by creating some false expectations. Exactly, yes. So what I'm first going to do is talk a little bit about energy balance for the Navier-Stokes equations. And let's just write it down here. So, of course, this is the equation that presumably describes all of the phenomena that we're interested in. And I'm going to look at a kinetic energy per unit mass given this way. So this is my kinetic energy density. And it's very trivial to derive from this equation the following balance relationship. Minus nu grad k. Okay, so here we have the time derivative. Here we have a space flux of kinetic energy. And then we have a dissipation term that looks like that. Okay, now the point is that this term only shuffles energy around in space. It doesn't destroy it. This is the energy sink term. And naively, if you look at this equation and the limit is nu goes to zero, that should imply that you have some kind of a local conservation law. So this is just the classical conservation of energy for the inviscid Euler equations. Okay, now let's think about what would happen naively in free turbulent decay according to this principle. So let's suppose that we create turbulence, for example, with some kind of a wire mesh running it through with some mean velocity.
Don't we have dissipation
in the plus? Nope. This is just a space flux. Okay, so there is a molecular diffusion of kinetic energy in space.
It's not really
a dissipation
on the right. Pardon?
Yeah, that's true. You should really be strained there, actually. Yeah. Put a symmetric thing there. So I just put an S there for symmetric part.
But you're saying the space flux also depends on viscosity.
The space flux, there is a molecular diffusion of kinetic energy. That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay, now suppose we look at the total kinetic energy, which we might be interested in a decay experiment, ddx. And ask the question, how does this decay? Well, if you just take the time derivative, this thing becomes minus nu grad u squared ddx. And if you look at that, it's proportional to nu. So you might expect that the decay will be slower as the viscosity goes to zero. Okay, now the answer is that in two dimensions, that's true. As you let viscosity get smaller and smaller, the decay rate gets slower and slower. But what happens in 3D is quite the opposite. In fact, experiments show that as viscosity gets smaller and smaller, the decay rate goes to a constant value. Okay, so this is sort of the surprising thing, is that the effects of the viscosity apparently don't disappear as you let it get smaller and smaller. So I'm actually going to begin by showing you these experiments. I just want people to sort of see the quality of the data, you know, with their own eyes that show these phenomena. Actually, what people see is if you, in the decay experiment, maybe I'll start over here, if you look at the decay experiment and you would define the rate of decay by looking at epsilon locally being minus the time derivative of this energy, and I'm going to look at averages, then this average goes like some velocity scale cubed over L. So this is actually a relationship that appeared in Srini's talk earlier today, is what he called the Kolmogorov estimate, although as he said, the experimental basis for this actually was known even before Kolmogorov. Okay, so it's actually a well-known empirical law for what happens at high Reynolds number. Okay, now just to be completely clear about the experiments, in some of the experimental situations, people actually achieved this by indeed using different working fluids. So in the same apparatus, you might use a water glycerol solution to change the viscosity compared with water. But in many cases, what you want to do is use hydrodynamic similarity. So what you do is you say, well, if I introduce dimensionless U hat parameters in this way, then the Navier-Stokes equations simply become, in dimensionless variables, this. So I just put hats everywhere. And the important difference now is that I get a 1 over Reynolds number sitting in front of the Laplacian term. Oops. Okay, so effectively you can realize this small viscosity limit by raising the Reynolds number, and that would mean that instead of actually lowering the viscosity, you might simply increase the size of the apparatus, where I'll remind you that the Reynolds number is just UL over nu. Okay? Okay, so let me start off with some of the experimental demonstrations of this empirical law here. And I will sometimes use the notation. All these experiments basically look at the same quantity. They look at a quantity epsilon L over U cubed.
What is capital U?
Pardon? Capital U is some typical velocity scale. For example, people will use in different situations different velocity scales. In many cases, it will be the RMS velocity fluctuation. Pardon?
Square root of K.
Square root of K, yes. In some cases, they might use a macroscopic velocity. Okay, now whether those are exactly the same or proportional is a different question. But in any case, some characteristic large-scale velocity, and this is some characteristic large-length scale, the integral length scale, or maybe the wire mesh in the grid experiment.
All actually, the sins are hidden in that symbol that connects the two.
Which symbol which connects?
That's
the symbol. Well, of course, yeah. I mean, here, well, symbol means, of course, Reynolds number going to infinity, but anyways. Okay. So first of all, as I said, the experimental evidence for this is quite old, and I'm going to first of all just show you a plot from Batchelor's 1953 book, but he was actually citing experimental evidence of Dryden from 1943, and what I'm showing you here is exactly this plot here. This is what I called epsilon, and then he multiplies by L divided by U cubed, and you can see that as you increase, well, actually, in this case, he's looking at this as a function of x over m, the distance from the grid. And as this happens, the Reynolds number changes as you go downstream. But indeed, you can see that this particular quantity here is sensibly independent. Now, you're only covering a modest range here, so maybe this is not so convincing. What I'm actually going to show you is, this is just to impress you with the antiquity of the observation. But the more modern experiment was done by Srinivasan, and so this is taken from a paper of his in Physics of Fluids in 84. And what he actually has done is he's plotted, now taking epsilon, multiplying it by the integral scale, dividing by U cubed, which is the RMS U, for, in this case, square mesh grids, and plotting as a function of the Taylor scale Reynolds number. And now you have a much longer range of scales than in the previous plot, and you can actually see that there's some initial slope, some initial decrease, which he accounts for with a power law theory. But at sufficiently high Reynolds numbers, you actually see that this thing levels off and becomes pretty flat. Okay, so this is actually saying again that you don't have a decay rate which is becoming asymptotically smaller and smaller, it seems that it levels off and becomes constant. So this kind of naive argument that the decay rate should be proportional to nu and should get smaller and smaller simply seems to be wrong. Okay. I'm going to show you a couple of more plots. Okay, so again, don't ask me any questions about these experiments. You have the author sitting right here. This is actually for not a square mesh, but for parallel rods. And in this case, there's a little bit more scatter. But you do see that things become fairly Reynolds number dependent. So I'm going to show you this warts and all. One important thing you might notice is that, in fact, the value is quite different than in the case of the square mesh. So actually here it leveled off something close to 1, maybe a little higher. In this case, it's different people's, yeah. So this is a collapse of a large body of data. Okay. And again, I'm not going to go into great detail about the experiments, first of all, because I'm not qualified. I mean, I almost electrocuted myself when I taught freshman physics lab, so, okay. In any case, the value of this constant does appear to be different, but there is some sensible independence of Reynolds number. Srini also looked at some other configurations, like an exotic one where he had these parallel rods and actually had holes drilled in the rods and water and fluid coming out, injected out of the rods in jets.
I just collected them,
sorry, okay. And here he actually again shows this quantity, but now as a function of the rate of injection, so the percent of injection against the flow and with the flow. And again, you see that there is some dependence of this constant on the particular experimental configuration. But in any case, the important thing here is that this constant does seem to exist and be independent of the Reynolds number. Okay, so that's the best data I know for the free decay experiments. There is another paper that I know in which people have looked at this in bounded flow, okay, which is a little more complicated, as we saw from the discussion this afternoon, but let me just go into that briefly. So this is a paper of Coday and et al. So this appeared in, let's see, I actually have the paper right here. This appeared in FISREV 97. And so here's their first apparatus. They actually had rotating cylinders, one on top rotating this way, the other one rotating the other way. They looked at two different kinds of situations, one where you just have smooth cylinders and the other case where you have little blades in here. Okay, so this is sort of where you're driving it with, in some sense, rough driving. This is smooth driving. Okay, now the situation there is a little more complicated in the sense that if you have things with rough drivers with the blades, then the picture looks much like what we had before. In this particular experiment, because it's closed geometry and steady state, they can actually measure three things. They can actually measure the power that it takes to drive it, so they can measure the energy input. They can measure the actual heating up of the experiment, which gives them the molecular dissipation. And then they can also measure the same quantity that we looked at here, this beta B. And as you can see, all of these things are close to balancing. They don't quite have the energy budget correctly. For example, they didn't take into account the actual heating of the apparatus when they were doing the thermodynamic heat measurement. So they don't quite get the budget correct. But in any case, it comes out pretty close. All these three things are about the same as they should be. And they all are quite sensibly Reynolds number independent over this range. Okay, so that's with the rough drivers. Now, for the case where you have the smooth stirring, things are a little more complicated. If you look at the actual energy input and the actual energy dissipation in the bulk, it does seem to decrease with the Reynolds number, maybe with some power law, maybe logarithmically. They fit it with a power law over this range.
This is the global Reynolds number, not RE lambda, right?
This is global Reynolds number, yes. Well, I mean, you're saying that we don't know how that relates with the Taylor scale Reynolds number.
This flow is dominated by global velocity.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, dynamics will be quite different.
Okay, so again, I'm not going to argue any experimental details. I just want to show you whatever evidence is available for the phenomenon. Okay. As long as they're monotonic functions of one another.
Yeah, that's a
Okay, that is, of course, a valid question, because we do want to say, does this actually extend to infinitely high Reynolds numbers? So we would like the Reynolds number, the relevant Reynolds number, to be high. And this looks like a big number, but you're saying...
I'm not sure you're responding to the other question. It's helical turbulence.
Well, I'm not responding to any experimental question.
No, it's not an experiment. Nothing to do with experiments. This is helical turbulence.
Okay.
So what do you expect from, why do you think it should be connected to grid turbulence?
I'm not making any suggestion that this is connected to grid turbulence.
The previous data was grid turbulence.
Right, so all I'm showing is the available evidence that I know for this relationship over here. The fact that the dissipation appears to be independent of the Reynolds number and to scale in this way. That's all that I'm doing.
The same reason is known for roof pipes and sluice pipes. So
yeah,
that's right.
Well, certainly the difference between roughness and smoothness is known in other contexts. That's right.
If you plotted this data for rough pipes, you'd get a flat line.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, you can't do a 2D experiment, of course. I mean, that's fairly hard. But I mean, in the case of simulations, you certainly could look at something like this. I mean, the important thing is in 2D, you don't even need to do a simulation. It's trivial to show. I mean, the point is that this quantity here in 2D turns out basically to be minus nu times the, you know, the entropy, and that's conserved in 2D. So this thing is automatically Reynolds number dependent, viscosity dependent. It does go down like nu. So it's theory, very simple theory. Okay. Okay, now the interesting thing was that they could also get a measure of the dissipation in the bulk by doing a little clever measurement with pressure transducers and then relating the PDF of the pressure fluctuations to the velocity fluctuations. This is hypothetical. But in any case, the point is, using this relation, they can actually make an estimate of the bulk dissipation, again, using this relationship, and they find that indeed that does seem to be flat. Okay, now let's not get into the whole issue of whether or not these things will cross at some high Reynolds number. We had a long discussion of that kind of issue in the afternoon session. I will mention that I believe, not for this situation, but for one I'm about to show, that Charlie and Peter have actually gotten, Charlie Doring and Peter Constantine for non-turbulence types, that they actually have upper bounds, which are Reynolds number independent in some of these flows. This kind of measurement suggests that perhaps asymptotically at very large Reynolds number, that is the correct trend if these things would eventually cross, in any case. The interpretation of the authors of this plot, by the way, was that the dissipation here, which you're seeing, is mostly coming from boundary layers, and that this is sort of the bulk dissipation. And so at these range of Reynolds number, the boundary level dominates, and only at very, very large Reynolds numbers would this constant piece take over. Maybe astronomically high if this was only a logarithmic decrement. Okay, I'm just going to show one more experimental plot and then wipe my forehead and get out of discussing experiments. Okay, so this was actually a Klett-Taylor cell, and they again looked at two different experimental situations. This is the one that Charlie has the estimate for, I think. So the point is that they looked at situations where you have ribbed walls and where you just have smooth walls. And in this case, they have just the plots here for the case of the the bulk dissipation itself. Okay, so they actually look at just the actual measurement of the dissipation coming from the molecular heating, and you see that in fact with the rough walls it's very nicely constant over this Reynolds number range, and with the smooth walls it seems to drop consistent with what we saw before. So this is the difference again between roughness and smoothness in terms of driving. Okay, so that's some of the available experimental evidence that addresses this issue. And again, I hope people are a little surprised by this kind of experiment, because on the face of it, it seems quite counterintuitive. In some sense, I think it's almost as surprising as what you see in superfluids, but in the opposite direction. I mean, in superfluids, you see that in some sense, you would expect to see the effects of viscosity, and they're simply not there. Here, we're doing the opposite thing. We're actually taking the viscosity getting smaller and smaller, and the dam dissipation just refuses to disappear. Okay, so I think, again, these are rather surprising experiments. And they're also very fundamental in terms of turbulence phenomenology. I mean, sometimes in the turbulence business, we get a little blasé about this because we say, well, this is just a dimensional estimate. But you have to understand that the Kolmogorov phenomenology is based in assuming that epsilon is a valid quantity and the limit is the Reynolds number goes to infinity. That is, that you can really consider the limit of infinitely high Reynolds number, and this thing stays fixed. So really, this kind of an experiment is very, very important in justifying the dimensional analysis that Kolmogorov did. So it's really unfair to say this just comes from dimensional analysis. It has to have some kind of a deep dynamical foundation. Okay.
Greg,
yes?
Are there any experiments which measure the integral which multiplies the viscous term directly to show that
The integral that
like in that 2D case.
Oh, you're saying that actually would, well, of course, you do see big gradients developing, and people have measured things like the flatnesses, for example. I mean, so there are lots of experiments in which people study not only, say, usually using one-dimensional surrogates, in which they would not only measure, you know, say, something like du dx squared, but even higher powers. So, yeah, there are experiments like that, and they do blow up. Yeah, and they do blow up, yeah. Pardon? Well, of course, this one blows up like 1 over nu. The higher ones blow up with different powers. Okay, so in fact, in field theory language, I mean, you actually see different anomalous exponents appearing for different composite operators here. So this one is one divergence, but you get other divergences for the others. Okay. Okay, I mean, I think most of those are not for the actual dissipation. Most of those, as I said, are for one-dimensional surrogates, but in any case. Okay, so the idea is it's very hard to get a measurement of this quantity because it involves all the components of the velocity and gradients in all three different directions at the point. So that's hard to measure. So what people will do is they will measure, say, just the gradient along the flow direction. Okay, so for example, in a grid turbulence experiment. And then in the case of homogeneity and isotropy, that actually should be related by a factor of like 1/15 to the average of the full dissipation. Okay, so you can actually... Pardon? Well, in any case, I mean, assuming homogeneity and isotropy, there's actually a simple relationship between this guy and the full dissipation.
But in all the turbulence talks I've heard, people are always emphasizing how things depend on dimensions tremendously. Mm-hmm. You yourself said from going from 2 to 3 dimensions.
Yes. Oh, there's a big difference, yes.
So how can people extrapolate from 1 to 3?
No.
Yeah,
so I'm talking about real three-dimensional experiments here. Okay, now the next plot is for Massimo Vergasola. Okay, so this is a plot. This is actually from a paper of Lars Onsager. Oh, this is not a plot. This is just from a paper, and I don't know if it's going to be easy to read, but this is especially for Massimo. Okay, so I now want to move over to theory. Okay, and I want to talk about a very nice theoretical picture that was presented by Lars Onsager on the basis of these kinds of measurements, and explain that and relate it to Polyakov's observations on how in turbulence fluxes are similar to conservation law anomalies that we see in quantum field theory. So I thought it would be nice, especially for Massimo, to just take a look at the actual quotation that Onsager made. First of all, he cited Dryden's paper from 1943 for this particular phenomenological law for the dissipation. And then he says at the very end of the paper, well, it's some interest to note that in principle, this kind of turbulent dissipation could take place just as readily without the final assistance of viscosity at all. So in the absence of viscosity, the standard proof of the conservation of energy does not apply because the velocity field does not remain differentiable. So in fact, it is possible to show that the velocity field in such ideal turbulence cannot obey any Lipschitz condition of this form with some power. This is maybe a little hard to read. This is r raised to the nth power for any order n greater than a third. Otherwise, energy is conserved in contradiction to this law. Because, of course, under the circumstances, the ordinary formulation of the laws of turbulence in terms of this kind of differential equation becomes inadequate and must be replaced by a more general description. For example, a formulation in terms of Fourier series will do. And then he refers to an earlier equation he wrote down for the energy balance in Fourier space and says, well, this kind of detailed conservation doesn't imply total conservation if the number of steps in the cascade is infinite, and this double sum of this detailed balance, I'm not going to go into details of that, converges only conditionally. So he actually, I mean, mathematicians like to say that Ansager made a conjecture. Actually, he gives a very terse explanation of where this comes from. His argument here is really correct. I'm not going to go into any details of the Fourier analysis, but I would like to just sketch here sort of the best modern understanding I know of Ansager's assertion, and then talk about the relationship of that with anomalies.
What year was that?
This was 1949. Yes. Okay. He was talking about 3D.
Okay.
No, the paper, half of it was devoted to 2D.
That was his 2D paper.
This was also his first publication of quantization of superfluid helium, you know, circulation. So he did a lot in this paper. Okay. Now, I should say that a lot of what I'm going to be saying is actually related to a recent paper of Duchon and Robert, so maybe I'll just write this down, which I think gives sort of the nicest encapsulation of our understanding of this whole problem. So it's a very elegant little paper that appeared in Nonlinearity just in January. So it's actually available on the web if you want to take a look at it. But in any case, it's volume 13, 249, and then 2000. So it just appeared in January. Okay, so much of what I'm going to be saying here, I'm actually going to take from their formulation. Okay, now first of all, the point is that Ansager's observation has to do with singularities. Okay, so I don't need this anymore. He actually was saying that the velocity field won't stay differentiable. So in the context that we're interested in, we're not talking about smooth velocity fields anymore. And we can't, as he said, use this equation as a differential equation in the naive sense. In fact, if the velocity field really does become singular, then this gradient that appears here in the nonlinear term doesn't make sense in the usual fashion. It only means that the velocity can exist as a distribution. And we know that if you take a function which isn't smooth enough, you can't multiply it by a distribution. Another way of saying that is that there are horrible U divergences in this equation. Okay, so you have to regularize this equation somehow for it to even make any sense.
Now, you said, and yesterday also, the problem is to calculate anomalous dimension in some field theory.
I didn't say that, but...
Oh. Hmm? I just said
that is...
Now, the field theory is...
Well, there's a difference, of course, between anomalous dimensions and conservation law anomalies,
right.
But...
So I take it that the coupling constant in the field theory is the Reynolds constant.
No. In fact, these are all strong coupling problems. So these
all strong coupling problems.
I mean, it's a highly non, it's a, some high, one basically. It's basically one. So these all these things have to do with strongly non-Gaussian, highly strongly coupled fixed points. Yeah. So it means they're hard, especially because they're not only strongly coupled fixed point problems, but they're also far from thermodynamic equilibrium. So you've got sort of two things going against you. Okay.
So the Reynolds number is not the coupling, but in Reynolds. The field theory, what does the Reynolds number appear at?
Well, it depends on how you formulate the problem, but I mean, you can do it if you do it in the way that Yehuda and Orsog did. I mean, you actually get something that relates the stirring. I mean, how does it actually go? You can introduce a sort of. You have a renormalization group flow associated sort of naively with an eddy viscosity, which is what you get, crudely speaking, if you start eliminating, in fact, I'm going to do that in a minute, if you start eliminating the high wave number degrees of freedom, you produce something which can be crudely accounted in terms of an eddy viscosity, which is like a running coupling constant in your theory. When you look at a non-dimensional version of that, that's basically the coupling constant, but the non-dimensional coupling constant's order one. Okay, so actually let me, in the spirit of renormalization group, now actually integrate out the high wave numbers of this equation and therefore regularize it. Okay, so let me just say how I'm going to do that. The way I'm actually going to integrate out the high wave numbers is in a smooth way. Ansager suggested using Fourier series, and so you might think of doing using just a sharp spectral filtering, that is really just do a momentum slicing and integrate out all the high wave numbers. That actually turns out not to work out very well. I mean, I wrestled myself with that a long time, and there are lots of subtleties there. So you can make things work in that way, but it gets very, very tricky. So it actually turns out to be better to use some kind of a smooth elimination, and just take some nice smooth function, G of A, say compactly supported and differentiable, and let's take it to be positive and have unit integral. And then the subscript A simply means that I'm going to take G sub A y to be equal to A to the minus D G of y over A. Okay, so basically as I let A get smaller and smaller, no. In fact, I don't have any forcing here so far at all. Yeah. At the moment, let's just consider decay. Okay. Pardon? Just in a local averaging function. Yeah. Although notice here, I'm not averaging. Of course, I'm taking a convolution, which means that in Fourier space, all I'm doing is I'm taking this and multiplying it by the Fourier transform, which is really this object here. Okay, so if this thing is basically looks something like a smooth version of a step function, I mean, I just gradually eliminate out the high wave numbers. Okay.
No, no, no. He's not changing the equation.
Not changing the equation. I'm going to filter the equation, exactly. So in fact, I mean, what I'm going to be doing here is actually something which doesn't appear just in abstruse mathematical derivations of energy balance relations. It's actually something that engineers use. This is something that people in the turbulence business call large eddy simulation. They actually take the kind of filtered equations I'm going to be talking about in a minute and use them in simulations. Okay, in any case, 25 minutes, okay, so I better pick it up. Okay, so let me actually take this equation and filter it. Okay, so if I take this equation and I filter it, the problem is that I get now a new equation which is not closed. I generate a new term, and this new term, tau A, is just of the form U cross U, filtering that, minus UA cross UA. So this is basically some kind of turbulent momentum flux or turbulent stress. I mean, this equation itself that we had over here just represents another conservation law, the momentum balance. And the new term that I've written down here, tau A, is the momentum transport by the small-scale turbulence that I eliminated. Okay. So I get this thing itself, I mean, satisfies its own equation, which now involves cube moments. You can actually write down a nice equation for it. But this is just the closure problem of turbulence theory in another form, okay? So now we get an equation which is not closed. Okay, but let's go ahead and analyze it anyways. Let's consider the energy balance for now, the large-scale energy. So I'm going to consider here now Ka, which is defined to be 1/2 UA squared. So that's just the kinetic energy now in the large scales. And let's say what kind of balance does it satisfy. The important thing is that because I've eliminated all the high wave numbers from the problem, this equation is completely regular, and I can do all the standard manipulations on it. Okay, so now I have a completely regularized, smooth object. Okay, and so the kinetic energy now looks like this. I get a balance relation which looks a lot like the one that I had before. Okay, now there's a new term here that gives actually a space flux of energy by the turbulence. This is the term, I mean, for example, for passive scalars problems, it would bring your significant other's perfume or cologne wafting into your nose. But in any case, we're not interested in transport here. We're interested in dissipation. What we get now is, in addition to the usual dissipation, this is dissipation just in the large scales, though, we get this term here. Now, remember, this thing is something smooth, and for any kind of a reasonable regularity of the velocity field, as you let nu go to zero, this term can be completely neglected compared to that one. So most of the energy sink is actually appearing in this term here. So I'm going to call dAx to be just equal, this is a definition, minus of this, in anticipation of the fact that this thing is going to be, in some sense, negative. It's going to act as a sink on the large scales. And you'll see that you actually get a very simple kind of usual Onsager force flux form for this large-scale sink or dissipation. Here you have some kind of large-scale strain. Here you've got the small-scale turbulent stress. And this is exactly the kind of thing that you would expect to produce the energy sink on large scales. Mainly the large-scale turbulence is stretching out the small scales, acting on the small-scale turbulent stress, and that's this sink term. Okay, so now what this represents in terms of the physics is it just represents a flux of energy at a given point x from the large scales bigger than A to the small scales less than A. Okay, and as I said, this term here for a fixed value of A is negligible compared to this one. This is the thing that's producing most of the transfer out of the large scales. It's not directly dissipated by viscosity.
Sorry, I may be the only one who doesn't know what the colon is.
So remember, these are both tensors. So, you know, for any sum I J A I J. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Of course, here the colon means something different. It means it's a definition. Okay. So now let me just say, what I want to consider is what happens when I remove the regularization. Okay, so we've regularized our equation, but now the important question is, what happens when I remove the regularization?
Did you take nu going to zero?
Not yet. Okay, I'm going to consider a couple of situations. First of all, I'm going to say what happens for nu positive in that limit, okay, for Lorentz solutions of the Navier-Stokes equation. So as a warm-up for considering what happens with the Euler, let's first of all just consider what happens with the Lorentz solutions of the Navier-Stokes equation. So for the Lorentz solutions of Navier-Stokes, I mean, Lorentz proved that, in fact, you do always have global solutions of the Navier-Stokes equations at positive viscosity. And in that case, this is for both 2D and in 3D. In 2D, they're actually known to be unique. In 3D, it's not actually known. But first of all, one of the results of the Duchon and Robert paper is the following. They show that in the sense of distributions, this flux term with positive viscosity converges to K plus P, U, minus nu grad K. Again, this is all convergence in the sense of distributions. So this converges exactly to the flux term that appears in the Navier-Stokes for the Lorentz solution. This term here, however, this dissipation term, dAx, converges also in the sense of distributions to some non-negative distribution. Okay, so that means that for the Lorentz solutions of the Navier-Stokes equation, you actually get the following energy balance, which just looks like this, where again, you have to interpret this equation as an equation for distributions. So in addition to the usual term from the viscous dissipation, you actually get a new term, which I'm going to show you in a moment, is related to possible singularities in the Navier-Stokes solution. So this is very much like an anomaly that would appear in quantum field theory. It's a new term that appears in the balance law, the local balance law. Okay, now, for the 2D case, it is known that dx is zero. So this anomaly does not appear in the 2D case.
Is there a deep reason for that?
Yes. It has to do with the fact, well, it's deep or not deep. I mean, it's well understood. There's no vortex stretching in 2D. And that's the engine that's driving this whole phenomenon. I mean, what produces the big gradients in the 3D case is basically the vortex stretching. And this doesn't happen in 2D.
Standard set of symmetry assumptions like reflection among others, can you find cases where D goes negative?
Well,
sort of the analog of an alpha effect in
I mean, you can, of course, you're saying that like in 2D, well, even in 2D, of course, we have an inverse energy cascade.
Right.
But of course, in the situation in the
thinking of a subgrid scale source rather than sink.
I guess the way, to really see something like that, I think you would actually have to have, a box that was infinitely large and have some limit where you were sucking energy out of the large length scales. I should say all these results are for periodic boundary conditions, so what will happen in the 2D case is that the energy actually won't be dissipated. It'll just move up to the low wave numbers and sit there. Okay.
I actually want to ask the case in which is more symmetry. Suppose I were to do this, suppose I were to do relativistic dynamics, and I write, so this equation is basically the divergence of the stress energy, something like this. It's also known, then you get a similar term.
I have no idea. I don't know of any work that's ever been done on relativistic turbulence. People have to correct me if I'm wrong.
You can think of the vortex stretching term, which is the term, as being a source of vorticity generation. Now, in 2D, you get vorticity generation for baroclinic terms. So if you put in like density and homogeneities.
Of course, here everything I'm considering here, of course, is incompressible. There are even like 2D Burgers, of course, who actually do, there you have a different mechanism. In that case, in 2D Burgers, of course, this thing is known to be positive. You can do all this for Burgers, and, so that would be a different mechanism due to shock formation.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay. I'm considering solutions to the Navier-Stokes equation, okay, but weak solutions. So these could possibly be solutions with singularities. No one has ever proved that the 3D Navier-Stokes equation does or does not have singularities. And for the 3D Navier-Stokes equation, the Lorentz solutions, this is the energy balance law. This is rigorously known to be true.
But the equation...
The equation is the Navier-Stokes equation.
But you derive the same equation from the Navier-Stokes.
That was only for smooth. Okay, so that was, remember, I began by giving the naive argument. You use smoothness again because I was assuming that I could do all these integration by parts. I was doing all kinds of manipulations just moving derivatives around. And that's not valid because I've got gradients here. Okay, so this equation here is correct, interpreted in the sense of distributions. Okay. Yeah, the Lorentz solution might not.
Or you add up all the contributions from the potentially non-infinity parts.
Yeah.
They all go into this.
So this thing is exactly related to any potential non-smoothness of...
If we knew that there were solutions that were C infinity, Z was C.
That's right. So, of course, it's known that for...
C
infinity is more than you need, of course. That's right. Of course... Yeah, that's extreme. But of course, yeah. In fact, I'll show that if you have even like Holder continuity, this will come out as well. If you even have Holder continuity, you can show that this D goes to zero. Okay, so you don't need much smoothness in order to get rid of this term.
Where did the regularization?
What I did is I took the Navier-Stokes equation, I regularized it, I looked at the balance for the large scales, and then I took the limit from that. That's basically, I'm not going through any of the derivations here, but that's where this relationship was obtained. By looking at the energy balance in the large scales and then letting that length scale go to zero is how you derive this.
But then the Lorentz solutions are solutions you get from here by taking U of A.
Okay, the Lorentz solutions are weak solutions of this equation, the Navier-Stokes equation.
What you do is
you take this equation, you regularize it, you look at the energy balance for the regularized version of this equation
by
this technique right here, for example. That's one way of doing it.
But then you have to know something about
tau. Pardon?
Then you have to make some assumption about tau.
No, you don't. This is an a priori result.
It's a theorem.
Okay, it's an a priori result. You regularize the Navier-Stokes equation. Actually, the way Lorentz does it is he actually regularizes the convection velocity alone. He does a slightly different thing. Okay, in any case, this is a theorem about these weak solutions of this equation. Okay, yes?
If you regularize the Chapman-Enskov procedure, would you get the same D?
Well, I would presume so. There's actually been work on that by my colleague Dave Levermore in Arizona, in which they've actually started off with weak solutions of the Boltzmann equation, these de Perna-Leon solutions, and almost shown, there's still a slight gap in their argument, that if you go through the usual incompressible limit that leads to the Navier-Stokes equation, that you recover the Le-Ray solutions of the Navier-Stokes equation. There's a small gap in their argument. Well, depending on whom you talk to, it's small or large. But the answer basically is yes. I mean, some of that analysis has actually been done. Okay, now the point is that, in 3D, all that's known is that it might be positive, and dx can be positive if there are singularities for Navier-Stokes. So if there are singularities for Navier-Stokes, then dx could be positive, strictly positive. Okay, now, let me say what happens about Euler, which is sort of even the more interesting subject for us. Okay, so here is a theorem for Euler. And the Euler theorem says the following. Okay, so again, I'm going to look at weak solutions of this equation. Okay, so now that's it. I need to make one assumption, which I'm going to have to assume, following Dushan and Robert again, that cube moments of the velocity are finite. Okay, so you need, at least the present argument requires that at least the cube moments are finite, which is fairly modest. Okay, then the same kind of argument shows that if you regularize in this way that I was discussing, then this thing converges to K plus P, U. This dissipation term, UA tau A, which I define to be dA, converges again in the sense of distribution to some distribution. And so you get a balanced relation that looks like this. Again, there is some anomaly term in it. Okay, now what can be said about this anomaly term? Okay, well, I'm going to actually show you some explicit forms for this anomaly term, and those explicit forms will explain the Onsager assertion about the one-third Holder exponent.
Tau A is something generated by the theory?
Pardon?
Tau A.
Well, there's no theory here. I mean, this is all just mathematics.
Tau A is something you can write down in terms of
the Nope. I mean, again, you can. I'll write down some expressions, but I mean, this is what it is.
Oh, that's tau.
Okay. That's tau A.
Right.
And that's right. I should say that all the limits can be proved to be not dependent on which G you chose. Okay, so that doesn't matter. Again, you might hope how you regularize the equation doesn't play an important role.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
You wouldn't be surprised by this result, because it seems like you've gotten the results that you're getting from the nonlinearity, possibly giving singularities, and indeed, new doesn't help you get out of that. So if
right.
You cross out new in the first place, you come up with this.
You're right. I mean, so in some naive sense, you're right. Of course, the structure of singularities you're going to have in the two situations is completely different. So here, I mean, it's known that for Navier-Stokes, that if you have any singularity at all, it can only take place on a one-dimensional set in space-time. Okay? Furthermore, some characteristics of what the singularity look like are known there as well. So if there is a singularity for Navier-Stokes, it's a very evanescent type of singularity. It can live on only a very small set. I mean, one has a quite different picture of the singularities that appear for Euler. Okay. Yeah, lots of different kinds of complicated things, multifractal singularities, all kinds of stuff. Okay, let me first of all just say something about the sign. In general, this thing is not known to have any definite sign, but Dushan and Robert actually proved the following nice result, which again is if these solutions are obtained by taking the limit of Navier-Stokes solutions. So you take your Navier-Stokes solution, let me index it by nu, and if you take, this is the limit you were considering a moment ago, suppose I take the limit where nu goes to zero, and I get an Euler solution in this strong sense. So it converges in this strong sense here. Then it can be shown that for the Euler anomaly, there is also a definite sign. It has to be non-negative. Okay? This, I should say, by the way, is a quite, in some sense, a very striking result, because it's known that for finite A, this is definitely not true. In fact, when people do simulations with these kinds of regularized equations, where they look at this term here, I mean, in a simulation it has half the time plus sign and half the time minus sign. Well, maybe not half, but there's a delicate balance. So it's not always strictly positive. But in this limit where a goes to zero, and if the solutions come from taking limits in the strong sense of Navier-Stokes solutions, then in fact this anomaly actually has a definite sign. In 2D, if the vorticity has some finite moments of order 3/2 or bigger, so I won't write that down explicitly, but basically if the moments of the vorticity are finite, order 3/2 or bigger, then that implies that again, for the 2D Euler solution, the anomaly is zero. So again, this kind of anomaly under some reasonable assumptions does not exist in the 2D case.
It is somehow connected up with the experiments that started in the beginning.
Which, isn't it obvious? Well, actually, I mean, well, the point is... Okay, well... I will try to make some remarks about relationship with, the experiments towards the end. Okay, let me just sort of try to explain the Ansager one-third. Okay, so this actually addresses people's maybe desires to have a somewhat more concrete expression for this anomaly term. And there are some very nice things that can be done. First of all, a little bit of algebraic manipulation shows that actually this thing can be written in the following nice way. This was an observation first by Peter Constantine Wynne and Idris Titi. And they show that this anomaly term could be written this way. Let me explain the notation. Now, you know, Bob mentioned that this...
Is that tau A or
D? This is tau A. Okay. And what I'm going to now do is I'm going to say, let's take literally this interpretation of GA as an averaging function. So now I'm literally averaging over A, not taking a convolution. Pardon?
The subscript A.
Subscript A indicates...
No.
The subscript A is on this angular bracket. An angular bracket with subscript A is defined here. It's the averaging with respect to this filter function. So I'm just taking an averaging locally over, say, like a little sphere of radius A is what I'm doing.
Somehow the U becomes the Laplacian U?
No. Let me explain.
Oh.
Delta XU, Y, is the velocity difference. No. So basically what I'm saying is that you can rewrite this stress as an average over the tensor of velocity differences. Okay, this is just a little bit of algebra. Okay, well now let's assume with Ansager that you actually would have a Holder singularity in the flow. Suppose that you assume that the velocity field in fact does have a Holder singularity at a particular point. That it goes like the magnitude of x raised to the h power as x gets small. Okay, well then it's not hard to show at all from this formula that tau a will therefore scale like a to the 2h. And it's also not hard to show that the velocity gradient of ua will scale like a to the h minus 1. Those are just simple consequences of this assumption and the formulas that one has. So therefore, this dA of x scales like a to the 3h minus 1. And if h is bigger than a third, this thing is a positive power, and as a goes to 0, the anomaly has to vanish. Okay, so remember that the physical significance of this anomaly term is it represents a flux of energy. So what this is saying is if the velocity field gets too smooth, then the energy flux gets shut off. Okay. Okay. Now let me just make a couple of remarks about phenomenological theory. Of course, in the Kolmogorov 1941 theory, all the velocity differences on average scale like n to the third for all n. And this basically means that in the Kolmogorov K41 theory, you're assuming that h equals one-third exists everywhere. So in a space-filling way, you have Holder singularity one-third everywhere in space. Okay, now we don't believe that that is true anymore. Now there's a modification of that by Parisi and Frisch in 1983, the multifractal model, which postulates a different picture. They say that you actually have a different Holder exponent appearing on different fractal sets that have different Hausdorff dimensions, dh, that's a different d. In any case, whether or not that picture is true or not, it's a very nice heuristic of what's going on here. And Ansager's result sort of nicely anticipates it. Okay. So there is some nice connection of this one-third with the statistical phenomenology.
H is
something which, you know, the theory of turbulence should give you. And in fact, as I said, in the Parisi-Frisch picture, they say that H, you have different sets S of H, and the Holder exponent H appears on that space set S of H. So this is contained in R to the D. And this has some Hausdorff dimension D of H. And you can show that there's a simple relationship between this D of H and the anomalous scaling exponents. Basically, by a Legendre transform, you can relate this to the scaling exponents for the structure functions, the moments of the velocity differences. Whether or not that theory is correct is a different question, but that's a simple heuristic picture of the spectrum of singularities that you should see. Okay. Let me make one more remark about this Ansager one-third and the Kolmogorov four-fifths law that appeared in Grisha's talk, because there's actually a nice connection there. Okay, so this is one way that you can see the one-third coming out. Duchon and Robert actually proved that there's another form for the anomaly. So let me call this d tilde of x. And you write one-fourth of the gradient of GAY.
One anomaly per day.
Well, this is, it's all the same anomaly. I'm just looking at it from different views. Okay, so let me write down this. So basically, I have now a third moment of velocity differences. So I take this regularized velocity field. Oops. Is there an A here? I think there is. Yeah, there is. Okay. So I take these third moments here, except something is, I'm not sure there's an A here. I have to actually check that. It's not so important, but anyways, it just bothers me. Yeah. Okay, so I don't know. I think these might be without. One of them might be without. Okay, so then the point is that they show that if you define this object, that in the limit as A goes to 0, this also converges to the same dx that we had with this other quantity. Okay, so this is another way of representing the anomaly, is in terms of this third-order moment here of velocity differences. The interesting thing is that this is exactly the form of the Kolmogorov four-fifths law when you don't assume isotropy. So if you don't assume isotropy, then on average, it is known that you get that the divergence of the average of delta x u squared delta x u is equal to minus 4 epsilon. So that's the form of the Kolmogorov four-fifths law without assuming any statistical isotropy. And what you can see here is you have exactly the same form for this anomaly term. Okay, but now not in a statistically average sense, but for an individual realization of the flow.
And your nobles are really deltas,
yeah? My nobles are, these are deltas, sorry. Sorry, yeah. No. Wait a minute. They were deltas before. Okay, delta. Yeah, you're right. Okay, you're right. Yeah, same thing here. This is a delta. Sorry. Yeah, okay. So I'm trying to be okay. So anyways, the point is that the Kolmogorov four-fifths law really literally is a statement that the average of d tilde A epsilon is independent of A. Again, it's a statement that the mean flux across the scales is constant.
When you say flux, can you think of it as a flux in K space?
You can think of it as flux in K space if you like. I mean, basically, the inverse of A is like a wave number. Ansager's original argument for all this, was, in fact, was in wave numbers, but that turns out to be a little tricky. Okay. Okay, well, I'm basically finished. I just want to sort of conclude by making three remarks. So first of all, I want to just say a word about the particle picture of this. I'm not going to go into detail about this. So as Grisha said, I mean, there are different ways of looking at these phenomena, the field point of view and the particle point of view. Everything that I've said so far has been sort of from the field point of view. But there's also recently been a nice set of work done on the particle picture of this in terms of Lagrangian trajectories. And I'm just going to mention it very briefly. Christoph Gawedzki is the person you should have talk to about this when he's here, because he is very interested in this and has done some nice work on it. So the point is, if you look at Lagrangian trajectories in the flow, because this U is no longer Lipschitz, you don't have unique solutions of this equation for a given initial data. And it turns out that the non-uniqueness of these Lagrangian particle trajectories is the particle way of looking at this anomaly. This is very well understood now in the Kraichen model. But recently, there's also been work by mathematicians. For example, Schnurlmann has actually used this non-uniqueness of Lagrangian trajectories to construct a globally dissipative weak solution of 3D Euler. So he's actually constructed a solution of the Euler equations that has this anomaly in. I should say that he only constructs something which is globally dissipative. It doesn't necessarily have this dx positive, but if you integrate over space, the energy decreases.
Sorry, I didn't understand the non-uniqueness of the trajectory. Is that because of singularity?
So yeah, so when, you know, in order to prove that a set of differential equations like this has unique solutions, U has to be Lipschitz. It has to be like have one derivative.
Okay. And when that's... This means first derivative.
First derivative, basically.
But
a little weaker, but... Say, so yeah, so if U is C1, that would imply Lipschitz, for example. Okay, and if you don't have that, then the solutions will be existing as long as U is continuous, but not necessarily unique. Okay, and now there's actually, in the Kraichen model, it's known that where this U is not smooth, that the solutions are not unique, and that's actually responsible for the dissipative anomaly of the scalar in that model. And a similar mechanism has been used mathematically to produce a dissipative weak solution of the Euler equations. Okay, so actually there are lots of problems for mathematicians here. I think that I should say that many of the mathematicians...
Could you think of the non-uniqueness problem here as a trajectory crossing?
It depends on the particular situation. I mean, in compressible flow, this is actually something you should talk to Massimo about, Massimo Vergasoldi, because he's done detailed analysis of this. In the compressible case, in fact, things tend to sort of clump together, to fall, to sort of collapse. In this incompressible context, it's more like a branching. You tend to get things coming out of the same point. Okay. Anyways, as I said, there are lots of problems for mathematicians here. Many mathematicians who I've talked to about this whole general picture of Ansager's find it to be a little bold, let's say, maybe even foolhardy, because even today, the class of weak solutions that Ansager was talking about have not been proved to exist. So there's no general theory that says that this class of weak solutions Ansager is talking about even exist. So, I mean, of Euler, yes. Pardon?
Are you talking about
No, I'm talking about just the general theory of existence of weak solutions, for example, with Holder regularity. Yeah, so I mean, like, or even with, you know, say with Holder regularity or L3, I mean, almost nothing. I mean, the only solutions that exist are very, very weak solutions, measure valued, actually. Okay, let me just say a couple words about the connection with anomaly. So this may be something that some of the hydrodynamicists don't know about, but anyways, let me just make a couple remarks. So in QED, you have an axial symmetry, and by Noether's theorem, this actually produces an axial anomaly. So if you look at the conserved current there, this thing is something which should be locally conserved in the absence of a mass. So you have an exact axial symmetry, for example, in quantum electrodynamics, when the mass is zero. But it's actually known that if you regularize things carefully in a gauge invariant way and then remove the regularization, you actually get an anomaly term. Okay, so this J5 is something you can write down. I psi bar x gamma 5 psi. So roughly speaking, in this balance relation, this is something like the viscous dissipation term. This anomaly term you can actually write down explicitly in the case of the axial anomalies in QED. They're the fine structure constant times the dual gauge field and F mu nu.
Finally, something I can understand.
Okay. Okay, so roughly speaking, the analogy is
what
that...
is J5?
This is.
Just write it down. This is the whole thing.
No, it's all written.
No, it works.
Okay, so this is the four vector of the flux. Okay, so this is a relativistic four vector. This is what I've defined right here. It's like the sink or source term with a mass. So you don't have axial conservation with a mass. This is like the viscosity term, roughly speaking. Of course, it doesn't have a definite sign either. Right? And so this is just QED with a mass. So you have like an electron, a massive electron. Okay, and so here, this is the anomaly term. For example, Schwinger considered a point-splitting regularization. And if you put in a gauge invariant regularization, you produce this anomaly term. Okay? So this is roughly like the anomaly term that we're talking about. So in that sense, Polyakov's observation about the similarity of fluxes and anomalies in turbidence seems to be very, very apt. I mean, there are some differences. One important difference is in the QED case, this thing can actually be written as a total divergence and absorbed into here. Mm-hmm. The point is that current that you write down is not a gauge invariant current. So in that sense, you can't really couple it to physical fields. Okay, it does have the consequence, though, that if you integrate globally, it disappears, and so the global axial charge is conserved. Well, let's be careful and talk about just the abelian case. In the non-abelian, it gets a little more subtle. So there is a little bit of a difference in the sense that this thing definitely doesn't have a definite sign, because it's a total divergence, and if you integrate it over space, it's zero. But there does seem to be some general analogy. So I'll leave it up to you whether or not you say that Ansager actually discovered the first conservation law anomaly in turbidence before it was done by Schwinger in quantum field theory. Okay, now let me just say a last remark. Okay, so this last remark is for Srini, who's in deep discussion with Charlie Doering.
No, I'm keeping one eye open.
Oh, one ear open. Yeah. Okay.
Now, okay. Anomaly has some amazing properties. I just mentioned one of them, mm-hmm. which is that alpha you wrote down.
Mm-hmm. It's not renormalized. That's right.
I think this is to lowest order in alpha, but if you cut it to higher order,
yes,
order,
exactly.
It's alpha.
Yeah,
zero.
That's right.
Some similar.
Well, I don't know of any such a relation. As I said, I mean, this. First of all, you can't sort of do a kind of one loop expansion here to get out this anomaly. I don't know any kind of perturbative approach of getting it here at all.
Right.
Also, I mean, there's a lot of beautiful geometric significance of this in terms of like a Tia-Singer index theorem and so forth. And I don't know of anything like that in the conservation anomaly. And in fact, as you can see, they behave quite differently because in the turbidence case, this has a definite sign. Nothing like that happens here.
And this is one of the reasons I asked about the relativistic case, when you have more symmetry.
Well, I mean, the relativistic case might be interesting, actually, even in the astrophysical context. But I don't know of any work that's been done on it. Okay, I'm just about ready. Okay, so first of all, I want to say, why is ideal turbidence important? And this is an issue because, as Srini is doubtless ready to point out, in real turbidence, dissipation definitely does not happen by this anomaly mechanism. It simply does not happen that way. You don't have real singularities in actual experimental turbidence. So this anomaly is not what happens. In fact, the energy is really dissipated by the viscosity term. In fact, that was the way in which the experimentalists measured the dissipation, was by measuring the way that you build up heat in the apparatus through molecular heating. Okay, so is all this just pie in the sky? What relevance does it have to real turbidence? Well, the point of it is that it's a useful idealization. I mean, Ansager was saying, well, look, this dA is not really constant for A going down to zero. Of course not. This flux to small wave numbers is only constant until you get close to some wave number set by the viscous dissipation. So when A is getting somewhat bigger than eta, where this is the viscous scale, well, then this flux cuts off. But as you let eta get smaller and smaller and smaller, this flux extends out to farther and farther and farther in wave number, or to smaller and smaller A. And Ansager was simply saying you can therefore consider the idealization that you actually let the limit A go to zero, and then the energy is lost not by viscous dissipation, but the energy just flows off to infinitely high wave number and disappears. Okay, now the point about this is that it can be a very useful way of simplifying the problem. I know in the passive scalar work for Bob Krachin's model, I mean, the calculations are enormously simplified by just taking the limit at the very beginning and then not messing around with viscosity or molecular diffusivity. You can put it in if you want to, But it turns out to be a very useful idealization to just be able to get rid of it. In some sense, it's very much like the thermodynamic limit in equilibrium statistical mechanics. I mean, people in the early days, some people said, well, look, it's silly to talk about the thermodynamic limit because, after all, real volumes are finite. Well, nowadays we look back and we laugh at those guys because we say, well, of course, they were missing the whole point. You're not really interested in infinite volumes. You're just interested in the asymptotics where the volume is large compared to the molecular scale. The same thing is true here. We're not really interested in what happens for viscosity going to zero. We're just interested in the asymptotics where the viscosity gets very small, so the Reynolds number gets very large. And Ansager seems to say that there's a very nice idealized limit that describes that situation. Okay, so anyways, that's all I have to say. Yes?
Someone referred to this earlier, but the truth is that this is an idea, the underlying equation that you're using are only idealized collapses of kinetic theory.
Right, so you're saying
the singularities may not exist in the kinetic theory.
Oh, well, you're saying, well, of course, I mean, the kinetic theory situation is in some sense even worse because the kinetic theories describe compressible things until you take an incompressible limit. In fact,
singularity is only in this hydrodynamic description. It just means the description's breaking down.
Of course, you're right. I mean, I should say there's actually a nice work that was done recently. This is relevant to your point of the hydrodynamics description breaking down, because some people would say, well, look, if the Lorentz solutions have singularities, that means you have to throw them away. After all, you don't really have a singularity. That means that some new atomic scale physics is going to play an important role. And actually, there's a result by Yao and, what was the other author, Kostel and Yao, in lattice gas models, where they rigorously derive the incompressible Navier-Stokes equation, even if there are possible singularities, so the weak solution theory. And so any new physics is only going to tell you which of these possible non-unique Lorentz solutions you're supposed to use. Some Lorentz solution does describe what happens in the incompressible limit. So it does seem that you don't have to give up these fluid equations even if there are singularities. The new physics will just choose the correct solution.
It'll give you determinism back.
It'll give you determinism back, yeah.
This is related to something that I never understood about this field, is why in this field people consider Navier-Stokes equation somehow sacred. Why shouldn't the equation of higher derivative terms? I mean, after all, in Einstein's theory of gravity, we know that in Einstein's theory, up to some scale, there should be higher derivative terms, and people study those higher derivative terms. And I think some of these things you've discussed sounds very close to naked singularities in some of these.
Well, I have to say, I mean, people.
And when you add the higher derivative terms, some of them go away.
Right? Experiments would have to depend upon the values of those coefficients.
Well,
no one has done an experiment which depends on anything other than
the But has people tried to add higher
derivative the next terms are the Burnett coefficients, and it's actually ill posed. They come in with the wrong sign. It gives you the next derivative term that's destabilizing rather than stabilizing.
I mean, there's been a lot of, I mean, as I said, I mean, the kind of result that I was just citing by Kostel and Yao is actually sort of an answer to your question, because they show that in this limit where the gradients of the hydrodynamic fields are large compared to the atomic scale, the Navier-Stokes equation with probability 1 describes what you see. Okay, so in that sense, you really are justified.
I don't know of any experimental observation you could not describe by Navier-Stokes.
I mean, unless you actually have a different kind of fluid.
Except
So you could have some non-Newtonian fluid, and then fine, you have to use a different equation. But
except turbulence.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. No, back here.
Yes.
Wait your turn.
Assumption number one you made about Euler, that someone has made, that the L3 norm velocity of integral bounded. Right. My calculations are inconsistent with that.
For the initial, you're saying for the initial singularity.
I'm saying that my calculations showing the singularity of the Euler equation have that diverging.
You're saying the energy is finite, but this cube moment diverges.
That's correct.
For the initial singularity. Well, you're talking about, I mean, again, there's a difference between what would happen at the finite time singularity, that first one, and then you have some complicated subsequent breakdown, and you have a set of singularities in the steady state.
Let's not but, think about what comes after that.
Well, that's, of course, what I'm thinking about. But
well.
this whole issue is involving that, not the initial singularity, of course. But in any case, make your comment.
I don't see this.
So look, I mean, a relevant thing would be if the experimentalists would measure this quantity, which is easy to measure, whether or not they would see that this thing is finite or not. So they can look at this third.
It can't be finite in any experiment, mm-hmm. because what I'm talking about is happening on such a small scale that it won't be observed, and over so few points that it's not going to be any significance to the overall turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
My question here is, okay, you think about the subsequent singularities, and you talk about the first singularity now. I don't see the relevance of any of this to understanding Euler or understanding turbulence if you don't understand what the consequences are of a singularity that doesn't obey your basic assumption.
Well, first of all, I mean, the cube thing is not necessary to get out the Onsager result. The only thing that they needed the cube for was to prove these results about getting convergence in distributions of this dA. Okay, so you don't need the cubic velocity moment constraint at all, except to prove this result about, you know, d going to a limit. Okay, so in some sense, I did that. I mean, the reason I presented it with their approach is that their approach, which uses this extra assumption, is sort of the nicest way to make the connection with anomalies in quantum field theory. I mean, it's not an important assumption. The only real assumption you need is finite energy. That's always used when you're talking about weak solutions of Euler, but that's it.
Now, the engineers would like to know what tau A is, right?
Yeah, engineers would actually like to have good models for that. I mean, this Tony Leonard, by the way, is an expert on that, so...
In 1D Berger's equation, we know what the singularities look like, and we can construct tau A to reflect that knowledge. But here we still have this problem.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, of course, I mean, from the point of view of the engineer, they would actually like to have models of tau A, and forget A getting small. They're interested in A close to the integral scale, so they don't have to spend a lot of computer time simulating the damn equations. So they in fact, would look at the same object, but from a somewhat different point of view. Actually, I mean, I would like to make a comment, though. Even A in the inertial range would be fine, yeah. Well, okay, so all that you can get from the kind of arguments that I was making here was how that thing scales, basically. At a given point where you have a given Holder singularity.
So, I mean, actually, this regularization procedure is what numerical methods do. They imply a certain GA. In fact, when Bob is solving his problem, whether he knows or not, he has a GA in there.
Yeah, sure, of course. I mean, of course, it's hopefully much smaller than the singularity that he's looking for, but I mean, you know, it's... Okay, I mean, I want to make a comment, by the way, about Bob's whole issue of the finite time singularity. I mean, first of all, there's nothing in what I said here, I mean, nothing in what I said on this talk actually implies the necessity of any finite time singularity. But I think you actually do see the need of a finite time singularity in the 3D, particularly for the decay problem, from other considerations. So, I mean, I think that the turbulence phenomenology would have to be changed in a very important way if there isn't a finite time singularity. This is not true in 2D. I mean, everything that I said could be carried over to 2D. You see that there have to be singularities in the vorticity field in the 2D case, but they certainly aren't finite time singularities. Okay, in fact, those are singularities that are like Holder exponent zero. And if you don't have those, you can't have an entropy cascade. That's the same kind of calculation. So you don't need to have, the singularities I've been talking about here are not the finite time singularities. To see that you have to have a finite time singularity, I mean, I think you have to realize that, you know, this 5/3 spectrum, if you really set something like that up, I mean, this is sort of language that my colleagues Vladimir Zakharov and Alan Newell like to use. This thing has finite capacity. I mean, it has a finite integral over K. It only can contain a finite amount of the energy.
I have a parliamentarian question. Can the chairman of the session leave before the speaker finishes?
Sure. if the speaker gives him license.
Yeah.